I'm Christopher Lydon, taking David Hoffman's tour of YouTube Nation. It's homey, it's cheap, it's much, much bigger than network television already, and it's barely begun to chew up what we used to call media and spit it all out. This is open source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. We're in James Dudarian's class on global media again at Brown University. Our guest is the decorated documentary filmmaker David Hoffman, but that was then. He has pushed through this cliche that we live in a screen culture and a YouTube world, and oh, we didn't know the half of it. David Hoffman, welcome back to Brown. Would you start with just this particular story, the WikiLeaks release of the shooting of basically innocent Iraqi civilians from an American helicopter that has spread like wildfire on YouTube? There may be a miniature there of a much bigger development.
Well, let's look at just a short time ago. You shot a little video, you sent it into the networks, and they did one of three things. They either stole it, changed it, edited it, and put on top of it their own point of view, the truth, or they bought it. I used to sell little clips to the news, and I got $10,000 and $15,000 for selling 60 seconds. This was a good deal. You didn't have any control over it, and they made you sign over rights saying, you have no ownership of this, we own it, and then came along YouTube. And this little video that these guys have done, have decoded, gets 2 million views, and the Secretary of Defense stops on his way to a major meeting to talk about it. This is a changed world. This means that this is truly bottom-up. Ordinary citizens can shake up government without having to use national media, which I deem as a basically negative. National media doesn't help the ordinary citizen communicate to government and make change.
The Pentagon probably could have talked the networks out of running that film. Right?
No doubt in my mind, James, don't you think?
Yeah, I do. But two events happened. One is the reversal of the weapon and the camera. In this case, we often talk about how, like, you know, the camera is a weapon. We can witness an event. We can use, you know, truth against power of one sort or another through the visual image and produce some sort of meaning, a political meaning to that image. But this event is just so overdetermined in the sense that the camera is a weapon, the weapon is a camera, the confusion by the pilot whether or not this camera was an RPG that might shoot down the Apache helicopter, the camera that is in the nose of the targeting system of the Apache then filming this, and then the most amazing thing, and here we've, I think, gone, you know, light years in technological leapfrogging, and is that you have a form of cloud computing providing the means to decrypt the image.
I would say one thing. Let's be YouTubian about this. Okay. Anyone who's listening to this and wants to search the YouTube right now will find tons of Iraqi veterans and Afghanistan veterans showing their own videos.
Mm. Yes.
This is nothing new. This is just the news of the moment. But I've seen incredible individual examinations by cell phone cameras. Let's acknowledge a cell phone camera. My droid, shoots HD. 1 hour of HD out of my camera. That's unbelievable. I mean,
we've come a long way from the Rodney King video.
That's right.
The disgrace of the Los Angeles Police Department. It did change the world. How do we get from there to here? And what's the essence of the change?
I believe that the ordinary citizen has power, that YouTube doesn't require a genius, that shooting something shocking has always been good filmmaking. Going to get a lot harder, by the way, Chris, when you have to shoot something that you feel very strongly about that doesn't have shock value. How do I, for example, I personally feel strongly about child abuse. Spanking, AOL poll said, 41% of Americans believe it's good. Hmm. I'd like to stick it to every one of those 41% of those people who spank their children. That's how I feel. Can I show a spanking that would get a million views? And if I can't, what could I do on YouTube to do it? Because I want to make that change. That isn't like so spectacular as Afghanistan.
Hmm.
But it's a social issue. The greatness of YouTube is it's really just begun. We are, as you said, earlier than the Wild West, you said to me before, this is like we're out in the desert and something major has changed.
Stick with the GI videos from Iraq and Afghanistan. Yeah. What are they telling you? And what are the guys trying to tell us?
You should search. I've searched. I know three that affect me profoundly. One is how proud these guys are to be doing the job and how much they are involved with the people. One guy went out. He was not a journalist. He went out for 6 months and filmed just the interactions between himself and his group in their little tank thing they were in and the people they were talking to. You feel totally sympathetic to American troops when you're done watching this guy. Hmm. Another one came back and said, I shot and killed some humans, and I only filmed them after they were dead. You can find that on YouTube, too. And how horrible he feels and how it wrecked his family at home. They're both the truth. Undoubtedly, they're both the truth. Hmm. And, you know, Americans, have always wanted a clear and simple truth. Like, I know how I feel about Sarah Palin. Good, bad, horrible, wonderful. But it isn't that way. In fact, war and everything else like it, I think, is much more complicated, and we're going to have to deal with that complexity partly due to YouTube.
I'm going to put my French theorist up front rather than wait for the end. we've talked often about this guy, Roland Barthes, who says, you know, images are polysemic. They have many meanings. So whoever attaches the caption, what's so powerful about the video gunship image is that you have a voice. You have a caption. You're hearing what the pilot's hearing and saying, and then you have that written out. If you had a silent image, what would it be like? Hmm. They'd be open to many interpretations, many more interpretations. But the fact you have someone who's sort of glorifying the violence, and people will say you need to do that or else people wouldn't pull that trigger. You have to be able to dehumanize your target, and that's what that banter in the cockpit was about.
That's right. I completely agree. The analogy that I come up with much better for people to hear about is surgery. I'm in surgery. The surgeon is about to cut open my chest, take out my heart, plug my heart into some device, and fix it? What kind of a mindset is he in? If he were honest, and he didn't know that I was recording him, because I've been in those rooms, not easy to be in, you hear things like, pass that over. How are you doing today? Did you have good golf? Oh, yeah, I need that. Okay, remind me of that again, would you please? That's what you'd be horrified. You'd never go into surgery. And you'd never get it fixed. Mm-hmm. And my excuse is, well, that's what he's got to do in order to do his job. I agree with that. Nonetheless, watching that video and seeing that person get shot is horrifying. You actually, in today's class, stopped the video before it because it would have affected the class. That's true. Seeing those words and hearing that, it sounds just like this. And he's dead. A death scene like that with audio is horrifying.
We talked about this before, but you know, can you imagine if the Abu Ghraib still photographs and video images, which were taken with a small Sony CyberShot, which doesn't have a sound capacity? What if there had been sound with that? The sound of the prisoner's head hitting, you know, the door to the prison cell over and over again, the thud, 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 this equivalent to the, you know, rat-a-tat-tat. I mean, the visceral impact, emotional impact.
That makes me feel good, what you're saying right there, because based on that, which I never thought about before, the future is bright because there will be more and more and more and more and more by thousands of these videos. They will have sound, and they will emotionally affect you. What will that do to the planet? It's got to make us more human, because this stuff's shocking, isn't it? Rodney King was shocking, and that was without sound, as I recall, right?
Right.
Yeah.
David, stand back from the WikiLeaks and the story and just walk us around this place. You say YouTube Nation is already vastly bigger than Fox or CNN. It's making much more money, well, for different people, that's another question, than the networks. It's bottom-up. It's popular. It's kids can do it. Kids have audiences in the millions for their mouthing off about one thing or another. Tell us about it. No disrespect to people who mouth off either.
I was going to say, you don't like kids who mouth off?
Hey.
Did you mouth off when you were a kid?
I did. I was definitely. There were people in my family known as Sir Mouth. I mean, that was our game.
I'm all for kids mouthing off. I really am. I think that makes a much healthier society. Okay, so let's just look at what's going on
here. How big is it in short? I
mean, it's more than a billion searches a day as of November 2009. A billion searches probably isn't a billion humans because people search more than one video. That's huge. That's almost as big as Google. It has 99% video market share, and everybody in internet world, all IT world, all Silicon Valley world is admitting videos where everything is going. It's terrible to sit there and look at your computer screen and read words. It's painful. It's you skim. We all skim. If you don't admit to skimming, you're lying, because everybody skims everything. I don't want my thing skimmed, so video is better. Now, when you search on Google, you search which microphone is best for my Canon camera. When you search on YouTube, you search Canon microphone. Google tells you that. What does that mean? The searcher is searching more generally. They're not as specific. Google is becoming more and more specific, and you get 150,000 responses on the left side of the screen and 25 ads on the right side of the screen. When you search YouTube, how is it finding what I'm likely to want? That's quite miraculous. Answer, what an algorithm. What a system that YouTube system is. And you put that together with video, and you make what I would call YouTube style. Let's look at YouTube style. User-generated. What an idea. The user generates the video that he wants you to watch. Not the expert, not the news system, not the talking head. What does that user do? Shoots it in his room. Doesn't have any lighting specially, talks right to the camera, has jump cuts, nobody cares. That used to be an absolute no-no in the news. It meant something wasn't real, so you had to put a cutaway in to make it look like the guy continued to talk. Length, 2 minutes to 5 minutes, maybe longer, it could be 2 minutes to 5 minutes. And what do you most care about? Well, you care about two things. On the smaller scale, you care about finding the people you want to talk to. I'm a person who's home alone. Try typing home alone into YouTube. You won't believe it. There's all kinds of people home alone, singing songs, dancing. They're home alone. There's millions of them. It's so intimate. It's
billions of karaoke singers, probably.
And thrilling. People who are saying, I'm home alone tonight. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to tell you. I'm about to draw on my wall. And it's really fun. You can make a whole television hour out of that.
You know, I while away much too much time on YouTube, but I'm looking for jazz recordings, you know, Lee Morgan or Sinatra or the Basie Band or all sorts of things. It's amazing what quality is there. And we're getting used to the rule that in the digital age, nothing disappears. It's
all
there. Let's
give Google credit. Google provoked the giant rise of video on YouTube by saying to the world, put your video up here, we'll help you. We'll digitize. I mean, that's making it possible for
you. It's completely new to me that there are these stars out there, these gurus, as you call them, that there is a whole Christian culture out there, for example. And we're talking multi-millions of hits and people. Introduce us to some of your stars.
All right. Well, let's look at how YouTube functions, because everybody listening to this knows YouTube. There are channels. A channel means a home base for somebody in which they place their videos. Most of you probably have never looked at channels. But gurus are people who have large amount, we're talking about millions of people who have subscribed to their videos and who, whenever they put a new video up, you get an email, if you are a subscriber, saying, a new video has been put up by John Jones. And you will find gurus on every single subject, from news, Sarah Palin, religion, this Afghanistan helicopter video, makeup. I can't believe how many there are on makeup for 16-year-old girls with pimples. There's probably 50 gurus who get more hits than I ever have gotten on any of my videos. And it's taught me something. I mean, if I really wanted to get hits, get one of those girls to run my video. So I did. I tried it. I mean, I called one of the gurus. I got them on an email. I said, do you mind speaking with me on the phone? I'm a filmmaker with 40 years history. Oh, yes, Mr. Hoffman. Love to talk to you. Talk to her on the phone. Would you run my video for your subscribers? You have 7 million and I've got 1,000. Yes, I would. Do you have anything that would interest me? I said, I don't have anything on pimples, but I do have things on teenage girls. So these gurus are more powerful than network television reporters. They're really extraordinary, and they're growing around the world, not just American. There are gurus and got to speak English pretty much right now, although I don't know how, but Google or YouTube is now translating in 35 languages, and I'm getting all kinds of responses in German, French, Dutch, Chinese.
Who is the Snuggo, for example, or Philip DeFranco? Who are some of these, you know, the real Brian Williamses of our culture.
What's well, they're not shy, although some are. There are actually some introverts who wouldn't actually go public with being themselves, but will on YouTube in front of their camera at home at night do amazing things. It also shows me that, you know, this is as big as porn. Now, let's be honest. Porn is 80% of, you know, what Google does? When you go to Google's home office and you sit in the home office, there's a screen on the wall that shows you 0.1% of all the Google searches. And they're going like this. And the first thing you notice is how complex searching is, how many different ways people come out. And I noticed there was no porn searched. So I said to the lady at the front desk, where's the porn? She said, oh, that's 80% of our searches. We cut that out right away. And every once in a while, a bit of porn gets through. But Google is about porn. That's the predominant thing being searched on Google. I think 60% of all Google searches have something to do with that, some ridiculous amount. YouTube just said no to porn. People have tried desperately to get around that. You will find hilariously funny YouTube videos attempting to get around the porn rule, but they can't do it. And I really admire YouTube for being so sexually entertaining, if that's what you want to see, without pornography.
So
that isn't an answer to your question, but it does lead to more examination of the YouTube phenomenon. And I think you're being unfair in this interview by considering me something of an expert. I'm amazed, just like you're amazed.
No, but it's fascinating that you have, I mean, you know everything about media, you have evolved with it, and yet you stumbled on a completely new kind of Louisiana purchase of media just in the last year since I've seen you. And I want you to take us all there. But also, before we get there, what draws a crowd on YouTube? What makes a video mm-hmm. work?
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the word viral, which came out of YouTube, really. I think, tell me, the audience, was viral out of YouTube?
No.
It was previously. I began to hear it first with viral video. Maybe
viral marketing started.
Yeah, that started
with the web.
Viral video, we know what that is. It's a video you want to pass to somebody else.
Right.
That's what viral is. Did I make a video that you want to pass to somebody else? And there are rules now for viral videos. There really are. You know that if you have a Domino's or any kind of thing, bottles or anything, falling down between rooms and thousands of kind of magic trick sort of things, people will watch that. Falling videos seem to be viral. Singing videos are viral. But the gurus have managed to reach 6 and 7 million people just by the nature of the way that they talk. Now, who's better as a journalist? The CBS News reporter or one of these gurus talking to, I guess, people who agree with them? Viral is very important to me because I've decided that as a video maker, that I'm not always going to look for viral. I'm going to look for my audience. My audience are people with white hair who are losing it. That's not viral. I've got to find other people with white hair while losing it. And that's a whole nother group on YouTube, not noticed by the number of views. It's who the viewers are. And fascinating, YouTube is letting filmmakers, makers of videos, know more and more about who's watching my video. They know. They know everything about who's watching my video. They know what's...
How do you sell your video? If you were going to put either, this video will make you laugh, or this video will make you cry. I mean, which is going to get more hits?
Those are two very good. Laughter, humor, hilarious gets millions of searches a day. Hmm. A day, so I find that a very good word. Cry, not so many. Make you cry? I don't want to cry on YouTube. I didn't do so well with that title. I had that title. Then I had this is the best video I ever made. Didn't do bad. I got a pretty good amount of hits. Then I said, this video will shock you. People didn't want shock. So you got to play with these words. You got to see.
Probably depends on the time of day, right?
I bet you it does. I'm fascinated. I know it's not relevant, except as we are all media people, to what YouTube really does know. It's unbelievable. We knew Google knew a lot because they're tracking what we're searching over time. But what does YouTube really know about me after months of my using it?
Well, that was the question
James Dudarian.
Prompted by speakers we've had before, but the surveillance quality. We are supposedly the viewer, we're the watcher, but obviously the watcher is being watched by those algorithms. They're looking at what are our appetites, what are our desires, fears, et cetera. How do you see that being parlayed into a business model first? But secondly, what's the risk in terms of, you know, just intelligence gathering about individuals?
I
want to put the paranoid moment into this radio.
Yes, I think that's important, and I think it's Well, let's look first at eBay. That's where it really began. eBay could have, in 1 second, told me how many people wanted a certain car, a certain bottle of wine, with priceless information, absolutely priceless. eBay knew markets. My wife and I were big eBay sellers, and we attended a national event that eBay ran in the United States. They still do. And at that event, they began to tell us what people were searching when. And I said, oh, my God, they're affecting markets. They never really brought that public in the way that they're not bringing public how they're going to clone the human being. When you ask any of the geneticists off the record, they'll say, of course we're doing it. Who wouldn't do it? But when you say it publicly, they say no. I say the same with YouTube. They don't seem to have done anything except find me. But the price, how priceless is information on how many people have actually searched get a job insurance and watched a certain video that tells you how you can manipulate the insurance companies. There is one right now on how you can get a Verizon Wireless a 2-year contract for free, seen by 7 or 8 million people. What do they know about that? Do they know who's doing that? Has anybody watched all the jihadist stuff on YouTube?
It's actually a class project. I'm afraid I'm going to be responsible for a major deprogramming at the end of this class. But the short answer is yes. And maybe during the Q&A, some people will volunteer some information about that.
I haven't done that myself, but I'd sure be interested to know how they're using YouTube.
What can you learn on YouTube about the mortgage crisis and the economic meltdown? I mean, that would be a perfect place to share stories or outrage about Wall Street or the politics of what...
Well, you asked a really good question. I really think it's good, which is, when will there be somebody, an ordinary citizen, to step up to the plate with a good YouTube video that provokes Americans to stick it back to the banks, let's say? He's just a person or she's a person. But she begins to get millions of views and millions of comments and other videos, if that person asks, just please put in your video about your experience with the banks.
Absolutely.
What trouble could that make that would be just wonderful?
But it's been done.
Do you remember the way that...
Yep. Eugene Jarecki with the Huffington Post. It's called Leave Your Bank or Leave Your Big Bank. It's a...
Oh, yeah. Move Your Bank.
Move Your Money.
Move Your Money.
Right. It's this Move Your Money movement, and he basically appropriated images from It's a Wonderful Life about the history of a small-town banker and the wonderful sort of, you know, the wellspring of emotion that comes from, you know, saving George, you know. And you can save the small bank and stick it to the big bank.
Beat the mega banks.
Is it working? Is it affecting people?
It's limited probably because people started to realize, geez, you know, I can't find that small community bank ATM when I'm in another, you know, city and I'm getting charges. I mean, there's a cost to it, but evidently it was sufficient that big banks responded. That whole idea of going viral, it didn't really have an impact until network news picked it up. Like
I'm
a
just
lot
gonna
of
say,
things on the web.
I think the reason maybe it hasn't moved things is that Congress still cues off the New York Times and the networks.
I would have another reason for that. I'd be really interested in both your feelings about this. When I look at this issue, I say to myself, is there a devil here? Do these group of people, the bankers, individually and as a group, mean to hurt me? And or do they mean to profit themselves enormously? And did they know they were hurting me? And in the real world of media, I have never seen one of these guys or somebody who undercovered them find them as a credible group out to do me in. Now, I could believe that, but I think most American citizens right now don't know who the enemy really is, even if people say they're the enemy. I get that. I get the Michael Moore's Capitalism movie. I loved it. And he yells at Wall Street. But what is Wall Street? It's just guys who go home to Roslyn Heights on Long Island and have a big house. Did that guy do me in? It's hard to make the connection. This isn't like
war. It's partly because they programmed our heads on the whole thing. I think Michael Lewis's new book called The Big Short would tell you, yeah, there were guys of kind of evil design. And Simon Johnson's new book with James Quack on 13 bankers would say, yeah, this is an oligarchy and they've taken over the government. Mm-hmm. And part of the thing is that they've programmed your head to think that this incredibly recurrent bad weather in the economy is good for you or inevitable or natural.
Mm-hmm. Just but accept me, it.
Yeah, but meantime, they own you.
That's terrifying.
Well, it's exactly the sort of thing in which, you know, a bottom-up populist, you know, hellraiser on YouTube might be what we're waiting for.
I was with Abbie Hoffman in 1968. We were filming a day in his life as part of a movie we were making on something called The Yippies. Would you remember The Yippies by any
sure,
chance?
Steal this
both
book.
Of you guys? Oh, man, you're great.
No, just old.
Well, anyway, this day with Abbie Hoffman, we came up with the idea of a scene, and he went, it's a pretty good scene now, I was his cameraman, he went into a telephone booth, and he came out in a Superman outfit, and he had a perfect body, anyone who ever looked at him, beautiful muscles, he was a great-looking guy, and he comes out, and he walks down the street, and all these FBI agents who were following him all the time, followed him down the street in the scene. It reached the audience over years. If you're saying there was an Abbie Hoffman today, and he got at these bankers in the way Michael Moore did so wonderfully off and on. But even Michael Moore is a big Hollywood guy. I love him, but he's a big Hollywood guy. Yes, I think that's right around the corner. And maybe by this radio show, we're provoking somebody out there because it doesn't take much. Now, you know, the fellow who wrote the book that just came out that you mentioned, I forgot his name,
Michael Lewis.
Yeah, I loved hearing him on the radio and television.
Wait till you hear his conversation with us. It's the best.
Because I loved it, and I don't know that I'd have the confidence that I could get in the door of the way of these big guys and actually talk to them, but he described evil, close to evil.
Oh, he does.
Yeah.
I think Alex Gibney did a pretty good job, gave us a sort of sneak preview with his documentary Enron, mm-hmm. The best, the smartest guys in the room. Mm-hmm. Took a very complex issue, broke it down, made it entertaining, mm-hmm. and left you with a sense of, you know, moral outrage. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
David, I admire your experimentalism and your readiness to find a new medium. Take the rest of us there. What's the practical course for people who love the idea of independent voices?
Some people are going to push back at this when they hear this, but this is the truth. The documentary always was for rich folk. It costs a lot of money to make a documentary. Any of the ones that James is bringing up are hundreds of thousands of dollars. Well, where do you get those hundreds of thousands of dollars? Surprising number of the filmmakers in my lifetime were rich, let's be honest. They didn't have to get the money. Their families had the money. That's not fair. Other guys spend 5 years and mortgage their house. You know these stories. And they finally make the documentary and it gets their day in the sun at Sundance and maybe they get distribution. Two of the 300 documentaries at Sundance really get distributed, and maybe one makes money other than Michael Moore. This is a lousy profession if you're in it to make a living for your family. So I was forced into new media by the fact that I made this movie in 2008 and called Sputnik Mania. It got really good reviews. Everybody liked it, and nobody paid money to go see it in the theater. Why would you do that? Why would you see it in the theater? It ran on the History Channel, got a very nice rating, and it was gone. And the next night they had Adolf Hitler, and the night after that they had the Korean War. That's what people do with documentaries. YouTube, now, how to make a living, I'll talk about separately, but YouTube is something new. I don't have to spend any time. In one night I can make a video of myself. I actually put the camera on myself in my editing room with no lighting, and I just put a hat on because I haven't combed my hair, and I shave. I try and do that, and I shoot myself, and I'm on YouTube. 62 seconds later, I put the thing up there, and I'm on. What a system. Now, making a living, we could talk about that separately. But that's why I'm there, because I can't stand it anymore to go pleading 80% of my time for the money to make the movie, 20% of my time to make the movie, and then I get a fight for Sundance, and you get into Sundance, and all the liberals are there going, oh, that's wonderful, you're so lucky. And maybe the distributor says, look, I'm going to pay you no money down, not a penny down, and after I make my $2 million back that I put into it, maybe you'll get a nickel, and you never do.
So. But this is part of a big downward adjustment of costs, of budgets, of production values. Maybe jump cuts are now fashionable. Grainy is okay. Do it on your telephone. But it's quick and it's easy and it's out there.
Yes, and YouTube is determined, by the way, to help filmmakers, the communicators. They say, and they just started it, the Sundance channel, you can now download a high-quality video, which you pay for. Lots of download. Will that eventually make money? Well, when cable television started, I believed, how the hell could they ever wire the United States for cable? What a ridiculous idea. It worked. I believe in YouTube. People will make a living from clips on YouTube, from subscribers. That's just beginning. It has to be profitable eventually. And I support everybody's effort to get around the system that cost you literally, I'm not kidding, before you're done, $500,000 to get your documentary in a theater. Mm. That's a lot of money, and very few people can do it.
In the meantime, millions and millions and millions of people discover their expressive selves. I mean, that they can talk as well as the next guy or gal.
Right.
Which is good for the country. This is, again, part of Emerson's dream. I mean, trust thyself. Every heart vibrates to that iron string. Speak your own mind. Follow the gleam in your mind from within, Emerson said. I mean, this is wisdom of 150 years ago.
Make mistakes.
Exactly.
Make mistakes.
Don't worry about consistency.
Finally, there's a method for creating media that has in it mistakes. Right. Live radio does too.
Sure. But that true is an old Emersonian American notion, like you must be a nonconformist. Consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds. You've heard that a million times. But suddenly we have the technology to do it. James?
You know, I love Emerson. We always seem to be talking about Emerson inevitably. I'm thinking of a quote he had that institutions are the length and shadow of an individual. Does this lead to more of a sort of an individualism, YouTube, rather than a community? I mean, everybody, YouTube, I saw it for the first time, I'm thinking, utopia, YouTube, utopia. But then you go to it and you don't see much about how we're all coming together on these issues. Instead, you see a lot of expressive individuals. Is that just the American version, or when YouTube spreads to other, you know, cultures, will it express those cultures, you know, basic ethos? I mean, what is it, the institution? Is it the structure? Is it the technology? Or is it the maker?
Boy, I think that's a wonderful, wonderful question, which I never thought about before, but you're absolutely right. YouTube doesn't lead to government. It doesn't lead to organized structures to run large societies. Yeah. It leads to individuals with opinions. And everybody, back to the Jeffersonian time, and you guys both know more about this than me, was afraid of the individual. At the same time as you honored the individual, if you give the individual too much control, you might not get what you want. And YouTube is the ultimate noisemaker as an individual. It's really true. That doesn't hold me against it. I'm not against it, but I sure necessarily wouldn't use it to decide on voting capabilities.
Do you worry about the downside, about hysteria, about mobs, about digital Maoism and phrases like that about sort of the herd on the web?
I mean, I'm just on YouTube showing my videos. It never occurred to me. What happens if YouTube Nation actually had a government? God, that would be terrifyingly individualistic. And I'm an individual who believes in individuals.
Maybe we can get some wisdom from the class. I know you all have some opinions on this. Why don't you share your own YouTube moments with us?
Mm. I'd like to hear from anybody who did anything with, for example, Jihad.
Yeah.
Jihadism on YouTube. I have no idea.
Yeah, tell us about your experiences.
My name is Jake, and I think a thing about looking at jihadism on YouTube is that you were talking earlier about an issue with your own work and it being appropriated by other people and having trouble with someone else taking credit for your work. And that issue, and I think a lot of happens with jihadism, is that it's the reverse. It's people propagating these messages and saying, Asahab made this, which is the Al-Qaeda media wing, and look at what they've done. And that idea where it's sort of the reverse of what you've been talking about, the individualization, where it's really the sense of a community uploading a lot of these different videos. Mm-hmm. And there are individual voices, but for the most part, it is more of showing these collective videos, and they're less being an individual as much as it is of this community. And do you think that that's something that will translate over to other? Because I think that is part of this global jihadist movement. I'm wondering is, do you see that sort of moving into other counter movements in terms of, you talked about neo-Nazism and like the 9/11 truth movement, things like that.
Stay there for a minute. Let me just ask you a question. I don't buy the concept of community. Do you? What the hell is a community? You know what community is? When I was a 60s guy, community was us against the big guys. We were the community. Turned out later the women's movement was partially formed because we didn't include women in that community. We took advantage of them. And then the black community had this whole community thing. I don't buy community. I'm a YouTuber. Do you buy that there is a jihadist community that gets together and says, we all agree on this, let's make a video?
Well, I think I wouldn't call it community in the idea that they have like a town hall meeting and everyone talks. But I would definitely say that, you know, there is people who share the same ideas, and there are forums, and there's a shared language, there's a shared font and shared background and, I guess, the way that certain verses are said. And it definitely feels like there's a common thread between videos and between posters in terms of what they're posting, in terms of the comments they're making. And the tags, you were talking about tags earlier, the tags are the same. There's like a there's certain Mujahideen in Yemen, and there's certain tags. And I do I would consider a community.
I ask you to consider this. Thank you for that, by the way. And I'm not in any way putting you down, because I really admire the class's effort to examine it. It's be fascinating to me. But here's a good way to look at it. I once had the job for a local television station in New York to film a Harlem slum. That was a job. Go up today and film this woman. She's got four kids, and she's in a horrible condition. Go film. Okay. Film one. I go up to the Harlem slum. I film four kids, snot-nosed, running out of their nose, holes in the wall. You are a dirty slob, lady. I mean, come on. My grandparents came to this country, and their house was clean, and they didn't have any money. You're a slob. I could have filmed that movie, no doubt, right? Does anybody doubt that I could make that movie and make it credible? You might not like it, but you're a slob. Movie two. How could society economically put a woman in a situation where she has a hole in her wall and kids with snot? Same scenes, different script. Different music, for sure. Same scenes, but now you, state, are to blame. Show three. You are a hero, mother. Because in spite of these holes and these kids with these noses, you have two jobs, no man, a dangerous neighborhood, and you survive. This is a story of survival. Story number four. Same footage. I am a Christian. I've seen these movies. Same footage. We're talking about what media is all about. It's about what tone and feeling do I put on this scene which just exists. And boy, when I'm trying to watch Palestinian and Israeli stuff on YouTube, everybody seems right to me. It's all terrible. That's how I feel about it. Jesus, the poor Palestinians. What an awful story. Jesus, the Israelis harassed for thousands of years. You finally got your home and they still harass you and they want to kill you and throw you into the sea. I get that too. This isn't easy. And I kind of disturbed by James's question, because really in a YouTube environment, everybody's got a good filmmaker behind them and a point of view and they're all equally good. And what do I end up with? The old Crossfire. I used to hate Crossfire. At the end of Crossfire, I very often said, boy, they're both right. I don't know what I think. Thank God for people like Sarah Palin and Glenn Beck, because I know I don't like them. It's easy. Not so easy.
You remind me of the Lebanon War. What was that, 2006, in which, there were real bullets out there, but then there was also a sort of dueling videos, reports from the front. And I think the Lebanese kind of won that round. The devastation of Beirut was pretty horrendous. But anyway, is that the story of war, James?
It's the battlefield is definitely on the airwaves. We've discussed, everybody knows full spectrum dominance is the theme of the modern 21st century military. And it's why I think the military just lifted its rules. It used to be soldiers, Marines couldn't post to YouTube. Now they can. They've gone back and forth on this issue. They couldn't blog. Now they can't. They just decided we cannot control this phenomenon. Wow. There's still, if there's operational secrecy issues, then they can say, okay, you got to take it down. You got to stop. But this is the new policy. So, and we'll see if it's like, embedded journalism, if it ends up helping them achieve their objective, or else leads to this, more images of both atrocities, but also good time stories, not good time, good stories about how the soldiers and Marines are helping local populations.
But every GI could be Catherine Bishop, could make Hurt Locker.
That's a big leap. Yeah. She had a pretty good budget. Might not have been Avatar size, but it was a pretty good budget.
Yeah, right.
My problem with Hurt Locker is that it's pretending to be a documentary with all the Hollywood tricks and Hollywood editing and manipulations.
For sure.
But it's got a YouTube look about it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Just shake the camera and, put some dirt on the lens and...
Yeah, and more.
Yeah.
And more. We used to purposely trip as camera people. When we wanted things to look real, you purposely trip. That was true. Whoa! Gee. And I can't stand... By the way, what is the show where they constantly wiggle the camera? The Hollywood show? Nighttime? What's it? Law and Order. How many people watch Law and Order? Watch carefully tonight, and you will see a little wiggle in the top of the frame, intentionally there to increase your anxiety level, and boy, does it work. And every time I point it out to my wife, she says, don't point that out to me. I don't want to see that wiggle. And you'll see the camera going. And it's on a little rotor at the bottom of the tripod that actually jerks the camera and makes you feel nervous and tense and something bad's going to happen. That's incredible. What a technique. It works. I'm not against it either.
Yep.
Stump the band leader here. Ask him a question you can't answer.
Hi. My name is Hess. Thank you for the wonderful discussion. I'm an Iranian-Canadian, and last summer, YouTube proved to be very revolutionary in terms of broadcasting what was happening on the streets. Almost in real time, you could see what was happening, who was being shot, and it had a tremendous effect. But once the protests were finished, no one was nearly as much interested in watching videos about the analysis of what happened or how to synthesize these images. So even though it was a wonderful medium for getting news in almost real time, and in fact CNN and all the other news organizations were using YouTube images in order to, as sort of these eye reporters or whatever they call them. So I wonder if YouTube is not just, another tool for accessing, this sort of information that you otherwise wouldn't be able to get your hand on. And beyond that, it doesn't really give us any kind of new capacity to synthesize the information that's out there.
I think that's a superb question. First of all, with that, I'm sure you would agree, let's honor YouTube for making it possible that that occurred, that we saw that. The government's trying to block it. They're actually killing people, and we're still watching. I say, my suspect is, millions, tens of millions of humans have emblazoned in their mind those protests. It is sad that there was nothing else those people could do. I'll give you an analogy from our era. It's really good. In 1957, Life magazine, which was the YouTube of the time, 34 million Americans bought it, and I don't know how many saw it, but they averaged like six people per magazine. So everybody was looking at this. And they had this photograph of this dog biting this black guy in the ass. I saw that photograph at 16 years old, and that was it for me. When Martin Luther King started to speak in those days, I immediately signed up, protested, because I couldn't stand that America did that. Had that happened, I know that I personally was so sickened by what I saw that if you, not you individual, you Iran, had given me a chance, any chance to do something about that, even the Spanish Civil War, go and fight with those guys. You know, thousands picked up guns in the United States to go and fight with the Civil War freedom fighters. It was the fact that the government was so skilled at shutting that down, impressively skilled. And where the hell was Obama?
Well, I have to ask David. I mean, for a long time, Google was quasi-complicit in that monitoring, censoring, shutting down of information coming out of China. Yet now they seem to have done the right thing. But you think that that'll be the same when this next happens with YouTube, say? Would Google, in one way or another, stand up for the right to see?
Well, we're on Chris's program, and I appreciate the chance to say this. I've never seen an organization like Google. I know Google from the inside. First of all, this is a 21st century company, unlike any I've ever worked for. And I've worked 40 years. I worked for IBM. I worked for Apple. I worked for Sony. I worked for AT&T and others. And I've never seen anything like this organization. It has values. The values are like 21st century values. And I believe, just like the news report said, Sergey Brin said, no, we're stopping with this China thing. I'm not going to do it. And he personally made a change. When have we last seen that out of a corporate structure that doesn't even seem to have a person? Does Shell Oil have anybody? No. I mean, I don't hate Shell Oil, but do they have anybody? I don't know. Who's Shell Oil? Who are any of these guys? Who's Coca-Cola? Well, Google is a somebody. And when you go into those offices, you like see something that looks like a fantasy Hollywood movie. Everybody on the planet that I know would want to work in this entity. And I believe it is a new type of corporation. I'm not to say they're perfect, but they have values. They can state those values. And the people working there, when you go down to the ordinary worker, you feel Google values, which the number one value being, we are trying to make information available to anyone in the world in the easiest possible way at a price they can afford. That's on the wall. You hear that down at the lowest level of the corporation. It's pretty impressive.
Hi, my name's Jenny. So I agree with you. I think it's really wonderful, YouTube's ability to sort of give this democratic, everybody has a voice. So I'm wondering, how exploitable do you think YouTube is? I mean, so we've sort of come up with this formula for what makes a video viral, you know, what search terms you can have to it. You want to have the jump cuts and maybe poor lighting. Mm-hmm. I mean, is it possible for people to start coming in? And I think you even admitted to trying to make your video look even cheaper than it actually was. So is there a problem? And that people aren't really approaching YouTube with this critical eye of like, oh, I'm looking out for somebody who might be trying to fool me. So I don't know. What do you think?
I really think it's a good question. I'll tell you what I think. If the viewing public doesn't change one bit of awareness, which it's never had in all the days of news, print news, and all the days of television, which is everything is created. That doesn't mean I don't feel an essential truth. If people don't have that, YouTube is very exploitable, really exploitable. You will have viral videos, we already may have them, that affect millions of people that Obama was born, was in a terrorist, you know, or Obama was, people were communists. I mean, that's out there right now. It's got several million views. People who believe it. Do they believe it because the video convinced them? No, they believed it before the video. So is it good for promoting very dangerous ideas? I get a lot of Nazi stuff that shows that Adolf Hitler was Jewish, and here's proof why he was Jewish, and he hated his mother. I mean, that's generally accepted by a community that has videos on YouTube. This is scary stuff. One of the great contributions we, this group of people in this room, could make is to make people more aware that you need to have a suspicious eye at the same time as a supportive eye. I think that's true.
David, I was just going to say, YouTube obviously is unregulated by the government. There's nothing remotely like a fairness doctrine. It's not edited like the New York Times. There's no fact-checking. What is the practical standard of truth?
Very disturbing.
On YouTube.
Yeah, very disturbing. I thought of you as you were preparing for this radio show, and I said to myself, you are a person raised with some journalistic standards that I do wish were still there, that you could rely on somebody. At least he saw it. I mean, I remember the days when the New York Times said they had to back something up with somebody else who saw it. We don't have any of
two or three sources and all that.
I don't know, James. What do you feel about that? I mean, there's no stopping YouTube, so you can't stop this. Government's never going to regulate it. No way that I could conceive of.
I think it's important to maintain a distinction between fact and truth. We've been kind of conflating the two. I mean, just now, finally, you know, how many years has it taken? The Sunday news programs realize, oh, maybe we should have fact checkers that immediately report whether, you know, this pundit was just full of baloney or not. You know, I'm pretty much of the school that if you spend all your time trying to refute a truth, I mean, obviously you can repudiate facts. That's pretty easy. But you're going to be behind the curve all the time because it takes a long time to assemble a document that can prove that something close to the truth. Instead, a lot of us in this class, what we've been trying to promote and practice is counter-truths. Present your own story. Mm. Counter-narratives, counter-truths, counter-media.
Hi, I'm Sam. I just want to ask you about you mentioned how YouTube gives this opportunity for this ordinary person just to deliver whatever he or she wants. But I'm wondering, and you mentioned also the capacity of YouTube to translate to like 35 languages with 30% accuracy. But I'm wondering about like the rest of the world, like African nations that still don't have like sufficient resources to fight like malaria. How will they even have like access to the internet, let alone YouTube? And just like the culture of in the long or short term, how do you expect the trajectory of like YouTube to play out in the rest of the world as opposed to just like Western Europe and the U.S.?
Mm-hmm. I think first, that's a really good question, which I'm no expert, but I think first of the time from one of my early years when they said that Indonesians saw American television, which caused a revolution in Indonesia because they saw refrigerators and other things like that. And I remember that. And I remember in Latin America, they said that a revolution was caused by the fax machine allowing people to fax where they were going to go. So the world is watching. That's a fact. On their little mobile phones, Chinese are watching these videos, most of which are coming out of English speakers right now, although not all, most. What effect is that going to have? I'd say, pretty profound. I'm thinking specifically of a film I made on double Dutch jump roping, which was seen in Japan and affected millions of kids to take up double Dutch jump roping because they saw this documentary made for PBS, which ran on Japanese television. What is the YouTube effect of that? The question is worth a class at this school. Boy, it'd be fascinating to see what videos are people in Saudi Arabia watching right now on YouTube. What are the popular – now, Google, YouTube knows it. Would they share it with this class? Maybe. If you said, look, we're doing a study. We want to figure out what videos are the most popular videos in a nation that isn't listed on the North America and Canada and Alaska. You ask a really profound political question. I don't know.
Smile, you're on television in Saudi Arabia.
Hey, I'm Meredith, and you've said that YouTubers are speaking to people who agree with them and that it's creating individuals with opinions, and I'm wondering if in some way it's solidifying people's truths instead of leading to further questions, and where the debate goes. Is it the comments, which are regulated by owners of the channel, or...
I think it's a really, really good question. There's no doubt in my mind that it is making it more likely that I believe what I believe, because I'm going to flip off immediately what I don't believe. After all, the greatest threat to the home communication system is the remote and the television. It's the single most powerful medium there is my ability to edit out you. It's not the television that's powerful. It's the remote that's powerful, right? And it is the ability to turn off YouTube if I don't agree with it. And I'm sure that people don't spend any time contemplating other opinions. I don't, by the way. If I don't like it, it doesn't suit me. I don't watch it. So you're right. YouTube is solidifying myth as well as anything else. Dangerous. That's right. You have no chance to change people's minds. You know, but off the subject, but really interesting, because these two guys brought up Emerson. I love Emerson too, but probably don't know as much about him as they do. But I want to say one thing about Emerson. I asked some guy in Silicon Valley recently, you know, Emerson wrote these things I can't even read. He wrote like 25-page essay on some one subject. Who the hell read that? Did anybody ever read it? And this guy, brilliant guy, said to me, at that time, people thought in a linear way, just like Emerson wrote. They thought linear, and they actually read the 25 pages with all kinds of analogies to God and the Bible and things in Roman Empire and other Greek poetry and stuff like that. Today, we truly have a different brain, this guy said. We multitask for real. We watch more than one thing at one time. We hear more than one. We hear bits and pieces. Our brains are not the same. We could no longer read or hear Emerson. But we can do something else, which we're evolving, which comes from bits and pieces. So, if I'm going to try and get around the person who is blocking my video because they don't agree with it, I better damn well know how to work in bits and pieces. How do I suck you in to your point of view and flip you to mine in 1 second before you've used the remote switch? Is a real communication tool. I mean, I've got to, and I do this in my videos now. I start you in one way, thinking that you're watching something on music, but it really isn't. It's selling Verizon Wireless. I've got to do that, because if you see a Verizon Wireless, here we are, Verizon Wireless, we're going to sell you our new phone, click that off. But if I got Bob Dylan and a piece of footage that Chris and James like, I'm going to have them for 10 or 15 seconds. And if I can have Bob Dylan really pick up a Verizon Wireless telephone because they can animate it so it looks completely real, they might be there another 10, and that's all I need. I do believe your question is serious, and probably long after you and I are gone, the answer to this question about where is the mind going and the brain going and our consciousness going when the system gives us bits and pieces, but our basic mindset is still to see what we appreciate and we agree with and immediately shut off what we disagree with.
You mentioned about how history, how the importance of sort of these new types of media, for instance, in knowing your grandparents or being able to see your house. How do you think that YouTube and sort of the mass ability to have access to record sort of history, however you want to look at it, how do you think that's going to affect how we see this generation? I mean, what are the gaps that it's getting and what are the parts that it's missing?
I really believe in the power of video to emotionally affect me and all the people who come after me. If I could see Abraham Lincoln give the Gettysburg Address, it would be better, I believe, than reading it. Would it be as powerful? I'm not sure, because I hear from NPR that ran an audio of a guy who heard when he was 9 years old, Lincoln give the Gettysburg Address, who said he gave it without any enthusiasm. He probably had to go to the bathroom. He rode up on his horse, which he was too big for. He gave the speech in 5 minutes and he walked off. It is not the Gettysburg Address, we know, but I still want to see it. I believe that if I could see my grandfather talking to his secretary in the Miriam Hospital in Providence, Rhode Island, I would know something about myself. Therefore, I believe that all of us, all of you in this room, all of us listening, should record like crazy, because I believe the future, we will find all these bits and pieces and they will provide us with a sense of who we were and how we got to be who we are that does not exist for any of us now. The most we may have is an audio tape or a picture on the wall of a grandparent or a great-grandparent. What does it tell us? These videos, these little moments. I put up the camera at a breakfast at my house about a month ago, and I recorded 1 hour with the camera not moving of the conversation around the breakfast table. I will never watch that video again. But 4 or 5 generations from now, somebody will run that video on a wall-sized screen with 1,000 people looking at it, saying, that was my people. Because we know we are the genetic makeup of the people who came before us and of the time that we lived. So I truly believe that this is an enormous change in history and our ability to appreciate history.
David Huffman, big paradox here. The last time you and I conspired on the radio, we were talking about the late, great Tony Schwartz, a friend of both of ours, who said that he made famous commercials. His doctrine was the critical message is delivered through the ear, not the eye. The video part, the visual culture is distraction. The essence, evolutionarily, the important way to the brain and the heart is through the ear.
I really am glad that you brought that up. I apologize for how I put video. I don't mean video. I mean audio. Audio drives video. The fact that if I had a choice and you said to me, you can see Abraham Lincoln or hear Abraham Lincoln, I know what he looks like. I have no idea what he sounds like. I completely agree with you. Everything is in the power of voice. That if you saw my face right now and you saw me speaking, you'd get 10% more. If you saw my face speaking and never heard me, as Tony Schwartz said, you'd get 1% of what I have to say. So thank you for bringing that up. You guys were very kind to me in general, did not attack me too much. And
I'm glad I asked. Thank you, David Huffman. Thank you, James Darian, for letting us back into your classroom. Thank you, kids.
Thank you.
Paul McCarthy and Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over till listeners add their two bits in comments on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.